All righty. We just had to catch up here a little bit. So here you go. I want to say goodbye till next week. So stay tuned for Peace and Social Justice, which begins now. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
I'm Corey Hemphunt, recording in occupied Machupta territory. Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Show. You may have noticed I didn't make it to last week's episode. I'll normally be doing the first week of the month. Thanks again to my co-host Chris for covering with that great show she did. You can go ahead and catch that in the archives if you haven't yet at kzfr.org. And also just thanks to everyone at KZFR for keeping this priceless platform alive for so long. It's truly an honor to be on the team. I take the responsibility of curating and creating these episodes lively serious. Today's show is far from an exception, as I'll be sharing stories and experiences of a dear friend, activist, organizer, rewilder, and all-around accomplice to marginalized people, Rain Cher, who graced me with the honor of joining them on a planting trek in reverence of their mentor, Phoenicia Medrano, who passed away a year ago to that day. For a bit of context, for those who don't know who Phoenicia Medrano has been, Medrano's obituary describes her as a charismatic, nomadic rewilder and a towering figure among rewilding communities in the American West, who is devoted to tending and planting native species and traditional staples such as biscuit root and fritillaria. Phoenicia traveled on foot, in covered wagon, and by horseback through Nevada, Utah, and portions of Oregon, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, California, and Washington State for 35 years, following a lifeway practice for millennia known as the hoop, a seasonal migratory way of living by following one's food source, hunting, gathering roots, fruits, and nuts while planting seeds and propagating en route. I'd like to take a moment and say rest in serenity to Phoenicia. In reverence of Phoenicia's passing, Rain had plans to make a trek to fulfill a promise they made to Finn. And I just so happened to reach out to them about having to push our interview where they would be speaking to the importance of wild tending back a few days. That was when they invited me to join the trek, suggesting if I were up for the journey, I could join in the ceremony and we could record a session for the show at some point while we were out. So, of course, I jumped at the opportunity and we spent several hours out on the hoop, identifying and exchanging with several plant people before sitting and recording a chunk of the day-long exchange around the importance of wild tending and Rain's shared memories of the inspiring yet humbling life of a rewilding icon. I hope you gained sapience from that session. Then to close this episode of PSJ, I'll be speaking with locally born mechatronic engineering student, native plant nursery technician, and TEK certified wild tending Rafael DeGenova about how they got into wild tending. They explain what willow walls are, and we discuss the connection between wild tending and social justice. We start on a windy day in a wild place as I sat with Rain on a hillside, and we were joined by a wild turkey who sat with us as I was asking, but also mostly listening. Enjoy. One of the things that I often hear you preach about is just the importance of seeing all peoples, not just those that we are bipedals, I guess we could call them. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I wanted to give you a moment to, in the introduction, to kind of just speak to your feelings around that.
So the dominant perspective that most of us were raised in comes out of the violence and domination and dominion of colonization and capitalism that inherently centers humans as the most important, if not the only important, aspect of reality in life, and of course prioritizes some humans over others, and historically has even sought to dehumanize and define some humans as less than human, because the foundation of the colonial capitalist perspective creates a hierarchy where humans are more important than anybody else in the world. And that has been a foundational cause of most of the harm that has been done in the world, to the world, by colonial capitalism, which is also inherently patriarchal, cisnormative, heteronormative, and classist. And it's why we have the current eco-collapse that is happening in real time around us. It's happening in a relatively slow fashion where a lot of people are able to sort of pretend that it's not actually happening yet. But climate change is here. It's already happening. It's been happening. It's been happening for pretty much all of you and my lifetime. And it's slowly speeding up. But you can't commit ecocide unless you live in this perspective that humans are more important. And it's the essential part of coming to recognize that we have this problem. It's kind of like an addiction. We have to admit we have a problem first before we can fix it. We have to admit that we have this problem that colonization has caused, that the colonial perspective is a death way. It's inherently a way of death because it is the inevitable product of centering humans above all else, is exploitation and death on a mass scale. And it's been happening for a long time now, where many species have become extinct and many are now endangered. And the only way to rectify the situation is to decolonize our perspectives. And as our friend Allie Metters-Knight, who's been on your show as well, brings up often, it's not enough to just decolonize. We also have to re-indigenize. Mm. And the re-indigenizing is the part where you retrain your perspective and embody the reality of seeing us as humans, as members of the ecosystem, who have reliance on the ecosystem and inherent responsibility to the ecosystem in every aspect of our life, not just as an afterthought or as a performative gesture like recycling, that every aspect of our life currently relies on exploitation and death on a massive scale. And we need to practice being good members of our ecosystem, good neighbors and relatives to all the people who live in our ecosystem. And it's something that's very vital in my worldview, and part of how I retrain my own brain is the intentional use of language.
Mm.
That when I say people, I don't just mean humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I will specify what kind of people I'm talking about. If we're talking about plant people, if we're talking about human people, if we're talking about deer people or beaver people, we're talking about specific plant people. And that's part of how I retrain my brain, is the intentional use of language. And it's part of the beginning steps of it. But the other part is the embodying and practice in your regular life, in your daily life, having a relationship to your ecosystem where you actually get to know and see the people around you who are not human as people.
Mm-hmm.
And you build relationship to them. And that relationship means that you will inherently treat them better than most of us have been for most of our lives as colonized and colonizer settler people. And that experience is slightly different depending on where you are. We live in Maidu territory, and specifically in Machupta Maidu territory, and the ecosystem in this place is specific to this place, and there are some things it shares in similarity to other places, but the ways in which humans specifically have existed in this ecosystem in equity in relationship rather than in dominating dominion is specific to this place and specific to the way that Machupta people have existed here for thousands and thousands of years. And that part about not just decolonizing but re-indigenizing is the part that my elder and teacher, Phoenicia Medrano, would sometimes summarize as saying, it's not enough to hate the lies, you must also love the truth. And it's a guiding principle of how I approach things.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR, Peace and Social Justice Show, speaking with Rain Sher, local activist, organizer, and wild tender. Peace and Social Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. The Wildflower returns this year on April 24th with a slightly different twist. A two-week-long extravaganza with three options to participate, special editions, merchandise, and virtual interactions along the way. To join the Wildflower adventure, visit wildflowercentury.org and on Facebook.
And I was going to ask, you know, were you raised with these ideologies, or what inspired, you know, this train of thought?
Yeah, I was absolutely not raised with this ideology. I was specifically raised with a colonizer perspective. And I was born on more recently colonized land, although the history is, of course, fraught with multiple layers of wars and territories and colonization. But I was born in the colonial state of Israel and raised by parents who were supporters of that colonization and identify as Zionists. And I was raised in an actually like more extreme version of that perspective than the average U.S. white person.
Sure.
Because it's an ongoing, more blatant violence over there as far as the physical violence of people fighting over the land. The colonization and the genocide is still happening here on Turtle Island that we now call the United States. But it's become more out of sight and out of mind for a lot of people and a little more subtle. So I grew up mostly over here, but my initial introduction into the world was very much with that warring colonizer perspective. And a lot of my growing up, I grew up in the city, in Los Angeles. And I also was much more privileged than the average person who lives in Los Angeles in multiple ways, including the fact that I had exposure to the woods and mountains and backpacking and things like that from a very young age. And so I was also raised with an appreciation of nature and wild places, and a reverence of those places. My dad and I had a lot of difference in perspective in a lot of ways, but we both see what we call God in the wild. We just define it differently. And he is part of the reason why I see it that way. Although a lot of his perspective was very toxic and detrimental. I have to be forever grateful for the gift of that, of teaching me to see the beauty and the divinity in the wild places. But being raised in the city and having no real exposure to indigenous people as a young person, I had that colonizer lie programmed into me that that none of that was left, really, and that Native people weren't really left and they weren't really practicing those old ways anymore. And I developed a very toxic, misanthropic perspective of humans as being a cancer on the planet and parasitic, and that basically we could do nothing but harm. And I felt very personally responsible for that. And it's a big part of the reason that I actually tried to kill myself when I was 14, because I didn't think that we should continue to live on this planet as consuming parasites. And I didn't see or know any other alternative. And so as I got older as a teenager and in my early 20s, I, you know, always had this sort of connection and desire to be connected to wild places and plants and nature. And I got interested in plant medicine and wild medicine, and a little bit in wild foods, but very much still from a colonized perspective, very much this disconnected sort of hands-off kind of approach. And it was one of the things that I knew from the very beginning that my teacher Finn was the teacher I needed and I'd been looking for my whole life without even knowing what I was looking for. And I love to talk about meeting her. I love to tell the story of how I met her, because I also say, and it's not much exaggeration to say that that meeting her kind of saved my life, even though it had already been over a decade since I'd actively tried to kill myself. I still had this very disconnected, grief-stricken lack of relationship to land and ecosystem and lack of sense of belonging in a very fundamental way. And a lot of the people that I had learned about plants from also had this kind of disconnection, and I think a lot of them didn't really realize it either, or understand it or articulate it. But I met Finn at I actually heard of her shortly before I met her, and so I had a vague idea of who she was, and that she was very, very special. And I met her at a gathering called Saskatoon Circle that is not currently happening anymore, but I went to for several years in Washington State, that is what some people refer to as a primitive skills gathering. Some people call them ancestral skills or earth skills, or there's various ways that people describe them, but some people think of them as sort of survival skills. It's, you know, the ways that humans have practiced taking care of our basic needs since we've existed as a species, basically. And there are some of those things that are just universal common things for all people, no matter where your ancestors come from.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where your ancestors come from, they learn to make friction by fire, or fire by friction.
Yeah.
And the basic physics of that is the same no matter what part of the world you're in. But depending on what part of the world you're in, you might use different wood and what's available in your ecosystem, right? And I saw... And the people who come to this gathering are all people who already have an interest in these things and have some knowledge of these things, and some of them very knowledgeable and very experienced, but often still in this kind of disconnected way. And Finn got up in this circle of people, it was about 200 people, and asked, how many of you have ever picked wild berries? Raspberries, blackberries, huckleberries. How many of you have ever picked wild berries? And, well, you know, almost every hand, pretty much every hand in that circle went up. And she said, okay, how many of you, when you've been picking wild berries, have taken that berry cane and bent it over to the ground and put it down on the ground and buried it so that when you come back next year, it will have grown more of itself and be making more berries for you and everybody else in the ecosystem? And almost every single hand went down. There was maybe two or three hands that stayed up. And it was this thing that people don't talk about generally in most circles that talk about wild crafting, wild medicine, wild foods. The reciprocity is the part that's missing. And it's the part that makes human life sustainable in the ecosystem. And it's who we've been, who we're meant to be, and who we've been for most of our existence as a species. And it's the invitation to actually build relationship and build an actual belonging in the ecosystem. And it's that thing that when Finn said, it's not enough to hate the lies, you also have to love the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth. Is that in order to belong in the ecosystem, in order to deserve to live off of that ecosystem, you have to feed that which feeds you. You have to give back and have relationship. And that's what love is, right? A lot of people say they love nature, but they've never done anything directly for nature. And they see it as this other thing that's separate from them, rather than somebody who is a member of their family who they love. Because when you love somebody, reciprocity is natural. It's inherent. You don't just take from somebody. That's not love. So if all I do is eat off the landscape and I never give back to those plants that I'm eating, that's not love. That's abuse. And that's the way that most of us have been taught to interact with the landscape, and we don't know any different.
And so what if people who are... when they give back, but they do it in more of a farming type manner, what is the difference between, you know, maybe just putting a row of corn in your yard compared to some wild, maybe Indian potatoes, for example?
Well, corn is an interesting example because corn is actually native to what we now call the Americas. And it is a really important example to understand the difference between horticulture and agriculture. Because a lot of a lot of people who live in the United States at this point have only ever received the colonizer propaganda of the history of this land, and therefore have an impression of the native people as primitive in this sense of we have this story that we've been told and we perpetuate that native people as so-called hunter-gatherers were, you know, just kind of barely surviving here. We're just, you know, getting lucky in finding food, that foraging was this thing where you would just go out and find what you could and barely survive. And that's absolutely not how it was in this place before colonizers got here. And it's very intentional, that narrative is intentional to create that hierarchy of colonization, that Europeans were somehow better than natives. But native indigenous people to Turtle Island have been cultivating this landscape very intentionally in very many ways for thousands and thousands of years. And they cultivated in ways, and still do cultivate in ways, that that fit into that reciprocity, that are not about dominion, but about working with,
sure,
and having relationship with plants and encouraging them in ways that benefit everybody in the ecosystem, not just humans. And the dominion, that, so that's the horticulture, is that the wild tending way in which you are intentionally encouraging certain plants to grow more. And in the landscape in which we live, fire was a very big part of that as well. Intentional good fire for thousands of years, and part of the reason why our landscape is now so endangered by fire is because colonizers suppressed and oppressed by violence and murder the traditional practices of fire that actually kept this landscape very healthy and safe. But there, you know, fire is just one aspect. The other aspects are things like digging roots, root foods that feed humans, also make beautiful flowers that feed pollinators and lots of other grazing ungulates like deer and other animals, and of course insects, right? And and so when you dig that root, you get food. And for thousands of years, there's been this hoop of reciprocity. And Phoenicia taught hoop ways. And the hoop, when we say the word hoop, we're talking about the geography of nomadically moving with the seasons and tending plants in their season, because every plant has a different season in different places. And Phoenicia learned from Shoshone people in what we now call the Great Basin region, Shoshone and Paiute people, who that was their traditional territory where they would move with the seasons. And that was most of her life was in that region, although she did travel all over what is now called North America. But that hoop can describe a geographic region that you nomadically move in with the seasons and have a relationship to all those places on that journey. But it also specifically describes the relationship of reciprocity, in that you do in situ planting, where you're spreading the seed to places that plant might not be growing yet or isn't growing very much. But you also do in situ planting, where you harvest the most at the time when the plant is in seed, so that when you dig that hole and eat that root, you also create that hole for that seed to fall into. And there's a continuation of that life, and that's part of how you feed that which feeds you. And certain plants that you dig that root, you might just eat the root, that tuber, that corm. And certain plants, like the Fritillaria family, make these little baby bulblets off of that big major corm. And they grow very slowly. These are perennial plants that grow very slowly by design. And so you might dig up a Fritillaria root that's the size of a silver dollar, and that root might be 25 years old. And it has all those little babies on it. And so you might eat that root. You might fry up that root. It's real good and bear fat. And eat it. But then you also have loosened the soil. And you spread all those little baby bulblets. And so in the act of taking, you're also giving. You're also encouraging more growth and healthier growth. You're aerating the soil. You're creating opportunities for that seed and those little roots to spread out a little bit and take root and grow and thrive. And that's the hoop as well, is that process where as you're taking, you're also giving. And that's the ideal way. And that's the way that indigenous humans all over the planet, no matter where your ancestors came from, if you go back far enough in time, all of our ancestors were wild tenders because it was a necessity of survival. And it's only with the creation of colonization and empire and exploitation that humans have been able to live in a way other than that reciprocity. And we've sped up this fast decline because we're consuming more than we're giving back.
Mm.
And it's inherently unsustainable no matter what you do. All of these, you know, so-called alternative energies are also a means of exploitation because we're using them to try and make ourselves feel better about the amount that we consume. But we're not changing how we consume. We're still just consuming. And we're exploiting the land by creating huge open pit mines for lithium, for batteries, for electric cars and solar panels. And we're creating, you know, a lot of toxicity in the water and the land by producing things like solar panels. And we've created this hyper-individualism where we're always stressing about our own individual survival. And for all of human history, we have been pack animals and we have survived out of necessity of working collaboratively with each other. And you can only have equitable reality and sustain that, right? And there's some hierarchy in the history of indigenous cultures, you know, where someone might be in leadership. But it's a very different type of hierarchy than what we currently experience in you know, colonial, industrial, capitalist culture. But that corn that you brought up was intentionally cultivated by indigenous people for thousands of years before it became what we now recognize as corn.
Mm.
And the traditional ways of cultivating that was nothing like how most people think of growing it now.
This is listener-supported KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm Corey Hunt, and I'm speaking with Rain, an activist, organizer, and wild tender.
A lot of people have heard of this concept of the three sisters, right, where you're planting plants in community with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like a tiny, tiny example of what we're talking about when we're talking about wild tending and understanding how all these plants interact with each other. Indigenous people of necessity, traditionally speaking, would know very intimately, and some people are left that still do, hundreds if not thousands of species of plants and how they interact with each other and how they interact with other members of the ecosystem, plants, animals, insects, and how they like to grow and where they like to grow and all of those things. And with that intimate knowledge, you can have a really loving relationship that is reciprocal. And that's how corn was for a very long time before colonizers got here, is it was a part of that big picture of understanding in a loving relationship that was reciprocal. And when you plant anything in a large monocrop monoculture in agriculture, you are divorcing yourself from that big picture understanding and creating an adversarial relationship with the ecosystem where you're protecting the thing that you want at the expense of everybody else in the ecosystem. And that's how you make excuses for atrocities like Roundup glyphosate, and you poison waterways and you poison the soil, and that wouldn't be happening and that wouldn't be possible if you weren't creating this industrial version of growing food that is modern agriculture, which is inherently a death way. It always has exploitation and death at the end of it.
If you're just joining, this is a pre-recorded interview I did with activist, organizer, and wild tender Rain Cher, as they invited me on a planting trek in remembrance of their fallen mentor, Phoenicia Medrano. And here is Rain sharing another valuable story of their experiences with Medrano.
The most critical part for me is that I watched all these young people coming up to her, asking her for advice and information and wisdom. And Finn preached the genius of generosity, which is the way that nature is, and that a lot of humans have divorced ourselves from. The genius of generosity is that giving. And some people are familiar with the fact that in indigenous culture, your wealth was not defined by how much you had, but how much you could give away. And that's the genius of generosity, is the more that you give, the more everybody wins. And Finn had a wealth of wisdom and understanding that she constantly gave away for free. And she was inherently against gatekeeping. And part of the reason that she was against gatekeeping, and she would tell people about very special spots and traditions and practices, and some people would kind of freak out and be like, oh, you shouldn't tell people about those special areas. They'll just go there and ruin it. And what she learned from experience was that, no, they won't. Most of the time, most people, they'll never even go there. Most of the people that she tried to give this information to would forget it the moment they walked away, would throw it away, would not understand the preciousness of it. But she would. Even these people who came up to her, who did not treat her like an elder, who did not offer her any gifts or offer to help her out, take care of her, support what she was doing, but came up to her asking questions, as young people in their naivety will do. And this young man came up to her and asked her, Finn, what's the best hoop in the country? And she said, the best hoop left in North America, the most abundant wild food garden left in North America, left as close to its abundance as it was for thousands of years before colonizers got here, is downwind from the Hanford nuclear plant. That's in Oregon. Is downwind from the Hanford nuclear plant. And those plants are being poisoned by that plant. And they desperately need humans to help them migrate. And he said, oh, where's the second best hoop in the country? And she said something about how the earth was dying, and he asked her, well, how long do we have? And she said, 10 to 15 years. And he said, well, if all we have is 10 to 15 years, then why do any of it? Why dig the biscuit roots? Why plant the ampa? And she looked him dead in the eyes and said, for your own goddamn conscience.
You've shared that one with me, and it is awakening. I hope it affects listeners in a similar fashion. I also, you know, I guess you're sharing all this information, so much powerful information, that, you know, I was blessed to like come across bits and particles of this in different opportunities. But a lot of people just really don't rub elbows with anyone who understands this type of information. And I know for me personally, when I first was hearing it, it can spark an energy, and then that energy is kind of looking for somewhere to go. And if there's nowhere for it to go, then it can dissipate. And so I wanted to give listeners an opportunity to maybe know some things that are local in their area and some peoples that maybe they can get to know.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, if anyone's listened to your show, and they certainly should listen to previous interviews you did with mm-hmm. Ali Metters Knight, that's mm-hmm. definitely a great starting point.
Yeah, that would be the Native Heritage Day episode with Ali. I actually have a couple episodes with her
that's
now.
Right.
And yeah, that Native Heritage episode, she goes in depth into some things for sure. Everyone should definitely check that out. Sorry to cut you off there.
Oh, that's okay. And yeah, and so ultimately speaking, the place to start is where you live.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of people listening to this show live in Chico, but maybe some people don't. And so if you don't live in Chico or Butte County, then certainly you should start specific to where you live.
Mm-hmm.
All of this knowledge is place-based and relational and is very specific, site-specific.
Sure.
But in the place where we live, the traditional people who hold the knowledge of the best technology on how to caretake this land are the Maidu people, and specifically the Machupta Maidu people. And we are incredibly privileged that even living within the city of Chico, we have access to incredible aspects of the landscape that still have some of this wildness, like Bidwell Park, which I wish we had a different name for, but don't give any credit to the Bidwells.
No. Or give them the credit they deserve.
Yeah, give them the dark negative credit.
Yeah.
But we are also incredibly privileged that that there are still original peoples here, and that Ali creates opportunity for anybody to show up any Friday to Verbena Fields Park, which is right in the middle of Chico. To come not only hear the information about some of these ways and specific plant people, but to get your hands in it, in learning how to rehabilitate the landscape specific to where we live, and that park used to be a literal dump that Ali has been rehabilitating for over 15 years now. And you can certainly check out her website. She's creating a lot of training that's going to be available for, like, you know, more specific workshop training and certifications. That's TEK Chico. TEK stands for Traditional Ecological Knowledge. But yeah, I'd say that's the really great, some really great ways to start if you live in Chico.
Mm-hmm.
But also just specifically slowing down and looking around and getting to know the landscape around you. You know, are there wild plants growing in your yard? When you go to the park, who do you see? And starting small and moving slow. There's a lot of, like you said, there's that sort of energy that gets sparked.
Mm-hmm.
And some people get overwhelmed. Mm. And that overwhelm, because they start to realize how little they actually
yes.
know, and that's overwhelming. And
yes.
so for a lot of people, that overwhelm creates stagnation. You know, they run away from it because it kind of intimidates them.
Embarrassing, sure. I can relate.
Yeah. And that's, you know, part of that story about Finn saying the reason to do it is for your own conscience is because you might not learn everything in your lifetime. You probably won't.
Mm-hmm.
You might not make a huge tangible difference in your locality based on the amount of destruction that's happened, especially when we're dealing with massively destructive wildfires. But that's not a reason not to do it. And part of what Finn experienced in her lifetime of work, and I also want to name very specifically that Phoenicia was a white woman,
mm-hmm.
and she was a white trans woman,
mm-hmm.
and this wasn't her ancestral tradition. But she did learn from Native people. And some of the Native people she learned from were the plants themselves.
Sure.
A lot of her learning happened by just spending the time and having a curiosity and a value for the learning. And you can make every excuse not to do it, and most people will.
Oh, yeah.
Or you can just do it. And Finn lived a very extreme example. She lived with very, very little money. She was staunchly anti-capitalist. She lived with very, very little money, nomadically on horseback, full-time, for over 30 years, living out in the wild. And she was very feral. And most people can't do that. Most people don't know nothing about horses. Most people don't know nothing about these landscapes, right? And you're not going to just go do that overnight. And by the time I met her, she was fairly disabled, and she couldn't live on her horses anymore. And at that point, she was doing it out of a truck. And she actually went through three trucks in the 3 years that I knew her, because she would buy these old crappy Toyota trucks. But she changed her way of talking about it a little bit, which was to say, get out and do it however you can. You know, everybody has different points of access and different accessibility and different starting points. But everybody can do it in different ways if they want to and if they choose to. And that's really what it comes down to. And that's the moral imperative of it, is that most people choose not to. A lot of people might not have ever even been told or even thought that they have a choice to try and do it.
Or a responsibility. Yeah.
And part of what Allie talks about, and Don Hankins, who teaches at Chico State, who teaches pyrogeography and is also Native. He's Miwok, California Native. He talks about it too, and I've heard other Native people talk about it too, which is that the population of humans on this landscape before colonization was massive. There were a lot of humans here, and the amount of tending of the land that was happening for thousands of years was able to happen at that scale because of how many people were doing it. And if every settler person who is non-indigenous to this land left tomorrow, there would be not enough people to actually rehabilitate the land, to do the work that is needed.
Yeah, at this point, yeah.
And so not only is it a moral imperative as a human that it's part of who we're supposed to be, it's central to who we are as a species, who we've been for most of our existence as a species. It's also a moral imperative of repairing the harm that's been done by colonization. And by and that's part of that hoop of that reciprocity too, is that when we make direct reparations to the land, it heals us too.
Oh yeah.
It's a moral imperative for our own well-being as well as the well-being of the land, to build that relationship and to learn how to be in loving relationship. And it benefits everybody.
Yes.
When we do it. And yeah, nobody's going to be perfect right away. Nobody's going to know everything right away. Not everybody can, you know, get a degree in botany. And in some ways you might be better off if you don't. If you actually approach it from a more open-minded curiosity that isn't dominated by colonial scientific taxonomy and colonial perspectives on conservation. The history of white people doing so-called conservation in North America has largely meant that white people were expelling indigenous people from the landscape and imagining the land as a place that we should not touch and leave alone. And the land will not heal on its own in that way. Just will not happen.
Yeah.
A lot of these plants, a lot of people don't realize that a lot of these plants where we live have co-evolved with human interaction for thousands of years. And at this point in time, their survival actually relies on humans mm-hmm. having interaction with them. If we leave them alone, they will die. They want us and need us to participate, to get to know them, to build that loving relationship and that reciprocity and that understanding. And so the place to start is wherever you can.
Sure.
However you can. Start with curiosity and the intention of having a conscience about how you live on this landscape.
Yeah.
And decentering yourself that, yes, it will benefit you, but it's not all about you, right? It's about the big picture. It's about reparations to the land, reparations to the original humans of this land who are still here.
Mm.
It's about supporting their leadership in that, because they know the best way to live on this land, because they've been practicing and refining that technology for thousands of years.
As I'm listening back to this and doing the editing, only I can see the wild turkey that's attacking the cord as myself and Rain are having this interview. It was an interesting day, very entertaining and educational, spiritually fulfilling and enriching. And I'm honored to be able to bring it to you here on KZFR. Peace and Social Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by local, seasonal, and organic offerings at Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinners. Find Farm Star Pizza at 2359 The Esplanade at farmstarpizza.com and on Facebook. The phone number is 343-2056. And by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. This has been an extended session with Corey Hamp Hunt as I've been sitting with Rain in remembrance of Phenicia Medrano. And as we close out this portion of Peace and Social Justice Show, I thought it very poignant to end on asking Rain why it's even important for any of us to do native tending.
Well, it's that thing about caring about more than just yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that thing about loving the truth. So a lot of people see the destruction of the exploitative ways that our industrial life is built on, and see the destruction wrought by corporate greed and all these things, and a lot of people hate that. And yet a lot of people don't understand what the real answer to that is, which is the truth.
Mm.
And the truth requires you to be humble, and it requires you to, be uncomfortable in recognizing that the way you've been living your whole life has been built on destruction and exploitation. Mm. And that's hard, and it hurts. And there's a lot of grief in this. But facing the grief is part of loving the truth. And it is that thing that, you know, I could talk about how much it'll benefit you personally, how much you could gain from it, how much you'll feel better, how much you'll be able to feed yourself and feel confident in survival and all these things. And I won't talk about it that way out of respect for the truth.
Mm.
And out of respect for my elder who taught me how to approach that truth. Because it's not about you. And it's not about me.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we're focused on ourselves is how we've gotten to this place of the earth dying in the first place. And it is important to me to name that today we're talking, we're doing this interview, being out on the land, and we're going to do some planting.
Mm-hmm.
Because this day is the 1 year anniversary of my elder's death. And when Phoenicia died, like other friends and extended family of hers, we all inherited this sacred duty to not only embody this, but to try to give it away how she did. And part of Finn's way was a diversity of tactics. So I can talk about it in different ways and different circumstances, but there's a lot of people who love Finn, and there's also a lot of people who hate her. And Finn was crude and one of the most foul-mouthed people you ever meet. And she was tough on people. And a lot of people, she kind of haze you. Most people I saw, she kind of haze you. She give you a hard time because it was that ego check. It was that test to see if you could be humble enough to care about learning about the truth, even when it was uncomfortable for you. Because if you can't get over that, you're probably not going to do it. And it's this fundamental thing that, you know, for me personally, I have a lot of intersectional perspective on this way. As a white person who is anti-capitalist, anarchist, anti-racist, all those things, as a trans person, I come to this from an intersectional perspective that there's a lot of people who kind of understand the philosophical part in the context of society. And if you can understand, especially for white folks, who of course have reaped the benefits intergenerationally the most out of the settler colonial violence, if you can understand how you need to be humble in order to improve the conditions of systemic racism, if you can understand how you have to own your own culpability and liability in it in order to address it, then you can start to see how that extends to your relationship to the landscape, and how your relationship to the landscape is also inherently racist. Because it comes at the exploitation, oppression, and genocide of indigenous people. And so repairing relationship to land and doing this direct reparations is also anti-racism.
Don't do that.
It's anti-racism in action, and it's some of the most radical anti-racism you can do. And it's also something that we talk about a lot in anti-racist circles, in allyship. You know, this is also the difference between allyship and accomplice. Allyship is this thing where, you know, it's kind of been watered down as a concept where you have some understanding and you care about people who are marginalized differently than you, whether it's white people caring about people of color or cis people caring about trans people. But being an accomplice means that you're willing to engage in direct confrontation of the injustice. You're willing to engage in being uncomfortable and even in some ways endangering your own well-being, sure. Whether it's doing direct action, you know, as a water protector or at a protest or whatever it might be. that's an accomplice, is someone who takes it to the next level where you're actively engaged and you're actively giving up privilege and leveraging privilege and giving up your ego and confronting the ways in which your own identity and your own well-being has benefited off of the oppression and exploitation of others. And there's this concept that we talk about called intent versus impact. And this is like a fundamental thing that if you can understand that in your ignorance, you had good intention, but you actually did harm.
Mm.
And you can recognize that harm and want to apologize for that harm and want to rectify and reconcile that harm.
Don't you do it.
Then you can apply that to this truth.
Sorry.
And the way that we apply that to the truth is to say, you know, this is how you can help yourself deal with the discomfort of recognizing that your identity and your whole life has been built on exploitation,
mm-hmm.
is to say, you know, I can recognize that my intentions were not malicious at the same time that I take responsibility for the impact of the reality. And taking responsibility for the impact and reconciling, rectifying requires of you to be anti-racist, requires of you to be decolonial, requires of you to be anti-capitalist, requires of you to be not just an ally but an accomplice to all marginalized people and especially indigenous people, and give direct reparations back to the land in the form of your labor. Money is something we can utilize, certainly if we have access to it. But your direct participation is actually more valuable in a lot of ways. And if more people were willing to directly participate, we wouldn't need to be doing the money part as much.
As you could probably hear, there was a turkey that just kept coming back. He was a huge fan, but Rain handled it like a super trooper and just kept spouting off the wisdom. So much appreciation there. If you're a huge fan like that turkey and enjoy the show, please go to KZFR.org and give us a tip. You know, you could tip us directly over there these days. So hopefully you take a second to do that. As we were getting ready to wrap up and get to planting, I asked Rain if they had any final things they wanted to share, and this is what they said.
I want to say that, you know, some other starting points for folks. I can recommend some books.
Yes,
I was thinking about
please.
That on the way, and living in California. And especially in our region, Tending the Wild by M. Cat Anderson is sort of a Bible of native plants.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a book that was not written by a native person, but it was written with all native informed information. There's also After the First Full Moon in April, Allie recommends that book a lot. That was actually written by a native person.
Okay.
For those who are interested in coming at it from a settler perspective, I will also recommend, if you're interested in learning about Phoenicia Medrano and how she came to be the person that she was, she also wrote a book called Growing Up in Occupied America.
Awesome.
And if you search for that, you'll find it. It comes from a little independent publisher, and they just print them when you order them.
Okay.
And the money from that goes to further wild tending. One of her students and chosen kin comrades in wild tending uses that money for the furthering of wild tending as well. And specifically in queer community, and that's something that doesn't always get named about Finn as well, because, you know, the totality of her life is so huge. And she, if you hear the stories of her life, if you read her book, there's some of her, a lot of her stories are, they're crazy. It's unbelievable. Mm. And yet it is, most of it is actually true. And I know, because I know people who were there for some of those stories, and I know people who've talked to people that she grew up with who verified those stories. And, yeah, I really appreciate that it worked out for us to talk today, and that it's been heavy on my heart, and it is real important for me to name that, you know, there's a lot of people around us who are older who are not necessarily elders, because eldership is a way of being, not just a measure of your age.
Sure.
And Finn was the only real elder I've ever personally had in my life, and that's even more precious because there's nobody in the world like her on many levels, and it's even more precious because there are so few trans elders.
Mm. And that concluded that interview. We got up and planted some peoples and talk to some peoples, and I appreciate Rain for sharing that and inviting me to that time, and I'm honored to be able to share that with you all in the name of Phoenicia, and I hope you all gain some sapience from this session.
Hi, this is Ray Lager, underwriting director at KZFR. In these uncertain times, one thing is for certain. You have to reach out to inform the public of any changes in your business or organization. If you'd like to be represented to our thousands of weekly listeners, please contact me at underwrite@kzfr.org or call or text me at 520-4742. That's 520-4742. I'd love to share some information about how KZFR can help you in these trying times. Please stay safe, and together we will grow a more compassionate community.
On that exact note, let's get into a little Bill Withers, Lean On Me.
Just call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. If there is a load you have to bear that you can't carry, I'm right up the road. I'll share your load if you just call. If you need a friend, call me.
Call me.
If you need a friend,
call me.
If you ever need a friend,
call me.
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 If you need a friend.
Bill Withers, Lean On Me, with such an important message of just, you know, reaching out when you need help and, you know, a reminder to reach out to those who might not be able to reach out. So let's check on each other out here and reach out when we need it. This episode was inspired around the idea of April Flowers and kind of trying to help our community gain a deeper understanding around plant peoples and, you know, just more than just cutting out flowers and passing them to each other as trophies without an understanding of the reciprocity. And I thank Rain for spending some time sharing Finn's legacy with our community. I hope we were all able to gain some understanding from that. I also spent some time in Verbena Fields with a local born mechatronic engineering student, native plant nursing technician, and TEK certified wild tender, Rafael DeGenova. And they were kind enough to share with me some ideas around wild tending, how they got involved, and some projects that are going on at Verbena Fields currently. So that's coming up next. But first, I wanted to just remind everyone to remember that if you see a swarm of bees this time of year, it's important that we call beekeepers and not bee killers, because the population of bees is getting lower and lower, and they are just trying to survive like us. So I... without further ado, here is the final Sapient Session of this week with Rafael DeGenova.
So who am I speaking here with today?
My name is Rafael DeGenova. I do wild tending and work with Allie Meadows Knight. I've always been into plants and gardening and things like that. I was very inspired by like Fern Gully and things like that when I was a kid. Worked with plants for a long time, did landscape management. Finally got my dream job, first dream job, working at a native plant nursery. And a point came where the nursery was moving, and there's a bunch of plants that might have gotten thrown away, and somebody pointed me towards donating them to the tribe. I met Allie Meadows Knight and discovered Verbena Fields. And got my first taste in, you know, being allowed to like plant and interact with the wild spaces around me. I've been doing more and more of that for a couple of years now.
So you're talking about, you know, rewilding, you know, even like our homes. You know, I think that's a great place to start. And I just wanted to ask, you know, kind of speak to native plants, you know, and the importance of native plants compared to, you know, what people may be more familiar with, you know, the more wilder invasive plant, or not wild, but invasive non-native plants.
Yeah. Well, what's really cool about native plants, especially around here, is if you figure out which plants are native to your area, these plants have actually been cultivated and brought, you know, together by indigenous people to form complete ecosystems. If you plant a good variety of native plants, you'll have things that produce flowers for pollinators and food for birds and other wildlife. Also, you know, for the benefit of the soil, most of them are nitrogen fixing, meaning they fertilize themselves. Most of them are drought tolerant and will actually keep the water in the area. Feeding insects with them actually is an important part of the water nutrient cycle, because insects hold water. We see all these you know, insects disappearing. That's a lot of gallons of water, actually, that we're not probably realizing are gone, just held, you know, contained inside a bug or a butterfly.
Interesting. I never thought of that myself.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, we're seeing you know, a mass extinction event and decline of everything, birds and insects especially. If you plant a variety of native plants, you will see those come back. And also, a lot of them can even provide you food, because a lot of them were cultivated for not just animal people, but human people.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Peace and Social Justice Show. I'm Corey Hemp Hunt, and I'm speaking with Rafael Dejanova, a local activist and wild tender. The Peace and Social Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010. Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as for medical and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com from quality 24/7 delivery service, and by Gearhead Barbershop, a one-stop shop for cuts and shaves, 1000 West Sacramento Avenue, Suite C, open every day from 10 to 6. Gearhead Barbershop offers men, women, and children haircuts, gray blending, facial shaving, and beard trims. Appointments and information at GearheadBarbershop.com.
I wanted to see if you could maybe bridge a connection between ecological restoration and social justice.
Yeah, there's a big connection, especially in California and probably in other places in the United States. But because the devastation that came to the land happened at the same time as the tenders and the indigenous people, a lot of the, you know, indigenous peoples and even non-human indigenous peoples, you could even consider the plants as peoples.
Definitely.
Have been removed from the land. The land's been removed from them forcibly through many different ways. People have, you know, a lot of the native plants need special tending, like fire, things like that, and there's been a big disconnect with us plowing the land over and destroying these gardens, taking away cultural resources from indigenous people, and, you know, including everything in the ecosystem. By restoring landscapes, you're fixing up the home of people that it was, you know, taken from, and you're giving the land back, you know, to itself as well. that's something that benefit everybody. And I think if we want to really do that, we need to uplift indigenous people and their, you know, superior knowledge about ecology. We want to survive. I mean, California might dry up, you know, if we don't listen, if we don't give land back. You know, things could get a lot worse if we don't.
Yeah, with things like these fires, you know, you got the ex-president saying things like rake the forest. And what really is needed, obviously, is a different style of forest management. And that's where I think TEK and things like that would come in hand on a national scale very, very valuably. And speaking of which, we're out here at Verbena Fields today. And as I look across, I'm seeing that you guys are working on these willow walls. Would you like to explain to the community kind of what that's all about and why you guys are doing that?
Yeah, it's really cool. So if you come out to Verbena Fields, and even at your own home, if you want to go on Google Maps and look at Verbena Fields from a satellite image, you'll see that in the channel there's little lines of plants that look, you can tell from a satellite image, they're very intentionally planted. Those are walls of willow. They were placed maybe like 10, 12 years ago. And what they've done so far over this time is they've caught soil and helped it settle and build up. The soil that we're sitting on right now, mm-hmm. actually you can see this right there.
Mm-hmm.
See how that's a line?
Yeah, yeah.
That was planted. And this was all just rocks.
Uh-huh.
And now there's like 3 feet of soil under us. And this is real soil we could plant, you know, plants in now. It's very soft and it's ready for planting. It's super healthy. So what we're doing over here is intending to the willow. So we can't burn it and there's no beavers here. We can chop it with loppers and try to mimic beavers a little bit, but not. But building little walls on the sides of these patches of real soil so that the next time it floods, because this will, at some point, this will all fill up with water here. Those will kind of act like whale teeth, and water will come up over these walls of willow that are basically look like basket walls, and silt will get trapped on the other side as the water goes back down. It won't wash downstream, so it'll build up and we'll get more soil. And it's a use of the willow, since we can't burn it like we'd want to out here.
Uh-huh.
We can use it as, you know, it's a valuable material for building. So we're building these little walls, trying to guide the water, guide the soil, and kind of thinking in like longer time scales like that.
As we wrapped up, I asked Dejanova for their three questions and a proverb, and this is what they shared.
Yeah, I think first question, what plants are in my yard? What should be there? What did it look like here 200 years ago?
Great questions.
I think my favorite quote lately has been one that you can find on the, I think it's on the tekchico.org, but I'm pretty sure it's from Ali. And it's in the Maidu language. It's Wasa Honi Mep. It's keep your heart's intentions good. I like it because we kind of are raised otherwise when it comes to intentions. We have the saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I think that that's a little misleading. There's this sense that humans are always going to be foolish and that humans are bad, we're a plague or something like that. But what I found is when we really are intentional about trying to do, trying to repair things, make things better, we certainly seem to be able to do a lot better than when we're being unintentional or when we think that there's no way around destruction and just act like that. Yeah.
Great. I thank you for your time and your works.
Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on your show.
The honor is truly mine every time. So many special people in this world, and I get a chance to sit with so many of them. Thank you again, Rafael de Genova, for your time and sharing your wisdom and your patience and your bravery. Thanks to Rain Share for sharing your journey, that spirituality, that wisdom. And thanks to Finn for passing that wisdom along for us to try and hold up that torch best we can. Thank you all for tuning in. I'm Corey Hemp Hunt. This is the Peace and Social Justice Show. We have Planned Dead coming up next here on KZFR. Stay tuned. And remember, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together.
And thank you for tuning in to listener-supported community radio at 90.1 KZFR in Chico. Thank you for another wonderful peace and social justice program here today. My name's Ray. I'll be your host today. We'll start off with the community calendar, and we will be right there.
Listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Registration is open for the End the Silence Youth Mental Health and Suicide Prevention Summit. This is a free virtual event put on by the North Valley Community Foundation, and it is open to high school youth, community leaders, and caring adults to shift the conversation around youth mental health and suicide. Go to nvcf.org and click on End the Silence to learn more and register for this free event that will be held this Earth Day, April 22nd. What's Bloomin' Downtown is a spring event currently going on in downtown Chico until April 24th. Local Chico businesses and restaurants have partnered with the Chico Art Center and will be showcasing what's blooming in their boutiques or their restaurant walls. You can check out and come support many participating businesses in the heart of downtown. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar.
All right. Thank you, Megan. And yes, it is time for Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. We're gonna start off with a show that's been sitting on my on deck circle for months, literally months now, and today's the day, so we're gonna play it. Really fun show, October 19th, 1981, Barcelona, Spain, baby. Yeah, I think it's the only show that the Grateful Dead did in Spain. I could be wrong. They might have done something earlier on. I don't think they were there in a 72 tour, but I could be mistaken. But I don't think they were. So, anyway, let's get right to it. It's a fun show. Beautiful day. Open the windows. Push back the furniture. Have some fun. Get outside. Be nice to each other. And please, please, please respect everybody's space. And be smart. Here we go. A one and a two and a hit it, boys.
The women we consider wine. We can share what we got of yours, cause we done shared all of mine. Keep on rolling, just a mile to go. Keep on rolling, my old buddy, you're moving much too slow. I just jumped the watch right outside the face. Took his rings, $4 and change. Ain't that heaven sin? Hurts my ears to listen and burns my eyes to see. But down the man in Culver, Shannon, might as well been me. We'll
we play for life.